this past week someone came here. We don't get it very often, just someone coming, needing help, just kind of walking up, and it happened. And as it turned out, he had just kind of made a mess of his life. And I said, all these things don't add up to a successful, enjoyable life. And so you have to walk on a different path. Now, do we need God's presence and his forgiveness and his grace that comes through Christ? Absolutely, you do. But still, there's a practical reality of how you live your life and what it adds up to and where it's headed. So buying into the culture doesn't seem to be a great idea. Or on the other side, you can just become really separatist, isolationist. You could just become hyperly religious, kind of hide under a rock of this religious rock and kind of live there and hope that it sustains you the rest of your life. But it doesn't seem to really work. But in the middle somewhere, we're talking about how do you live your life in Babylon? And the two we've covered so far, first of all, was Daniel. And that we put that word on Daniel that he lived with tremendous integrity. It says early in the book of Daniel, he says, I determined that I would not defile myself, that I would not buy into the culture and defile what God wants to do in my world and in me and through me. And I determined that. And really, Daniel's life is a whole series of events that he decided, I'm not going to defile myself, but I'm going to walk with my God. And God used him in amazing ways. And it wasn't easy. Chapter 6 of Daniel, he ends up in a lion's den because he committed that he would pray. And then people said, well, you're not supposed to pray. You're supposed to only pray to the king of Persia. And he says, but he continued to pray. And the king said, man, I don't want to do this to you, but I'm going to put you in a lion's den. I hope you survive. And the king was up all night worried about Daniel. He got up the next morning, Daniel was still alive. And all the people who set him up to get caught were put in the lion's den, just so you know, they didn't make it through. So Daniel, his integrity. The next week we talked about Jeremiah. That was last week. We talked about hope. A man's life that was very hard, and yet his heart's focus was on the hope of God's restorative work in the long run, that in his providence and in his sovereignty, he was going to work all things together for good for those who loved God and were called according to his purpose. He did that in the life of Jeremiah. Jeremiah died. He was killed by his own countrymen in Egypt. He was taken there and stoned to death. But he knew of the hope of God. I wonder if that integrity and hope could lead us. In fact, here, the chronology of the Old Testament, we're talking about this time of the exile of the Jews from Israel to Babylon about roughly 500-600 years before the coming of Christ. This was kind of a really key time. After that, God didn't send a prophet to speak to Israel for 400 years until John the Baptist showed up and began to speak for the purposes of God. So if you take that area or that time of the exile and the rebuilding and blow it up here, we've talked about Daniel, we've talked about Jeremiah. Today, we're going to talk about Ezra and Nehemiah, really primarily Nehemiah. And really, Ezra, they came and rebuilt the temple, he and Zerubbabel. And then we have Nehemiah, who's going to come and rebuild the walls around Jerusalem. And it's really an important time. So the question is this: how did Nehemiah navigate living in Babylon? How did he do it? Why was he so successful? What did he bring to the table that helped him through? The question then would be, how can we manage living in a post-Christian culture that's going through such profound and radical changes? How could we survive living in Babylon? What do we do with that? Now, there's part of us that wants to say, I don't know, I just want Babylon to go away. I want to go back to non-Babylonian times. Well, guess what? I don't think we're going back. I think we're going to live in the midst of it. We're going to have to navigate it. We're going to have to figure it out. How do we do that? And so we're going to answer that question today, and I think it's this. How did Nehemiah navigate living in Babylon? Here's the word: wisdom. I think the word is wisdom. Now, you guys, wisdom, it's not very pizzazzy. It's not very sexy, right? I mean, we want something a little more spectacular than wisdom. Could you just get some religious confetti, and could we do that to life and just kind of spread it all over? We could put it in the ceilings and then pull a trigger, and it just all comes down, and we go, yeah, okay, that's a Christian life, and everything's going to be great, and it's going to be really easy, and it's going to be fun, and all we just have to do is come to church, and we'll turn on the smoke machines, and I mean, isn't that what we actually want? It is, but it doesn't work. And so the word we've used for Nehemiah is wisdom, and it means this: the quality of having experience, knowledge, and good judgment. the quality of having experience, knowledge, and good judgment. You guys, wisdom isn't automatic. It takes time. It takes experience. It takes having good judgment of what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad. Wisdom is not easy. It's kind of akin to the words discernment and discretion, which means this: the quality of behaving or speaking with truthful courage in such a way as to avoid, or at least try to avoid, causing unnecessary conflict or offense. This is what Nehemiah did. He said it so well. Now, it doesn't mean that he can control everything, but he dealt with it with discernment and discretion, which I think is cousins to the word wisdom. Yes, I've been picturing how often in recent years Christians have spoken up in different environments. They've done it boldly, but with very little discretion, very little wisdom, very little discernment at times, and how important it would be to say it well, thought through, profound. I think that we live in a day and age where we're going to have to do that more and better. So let's just look real quickly. Nehemiah. The name Nehemiah means God is my comfort. Now, just so you know, in both Hebrew and in Greek, the word comfort, when we think of comfort, we kind of think about a soft blanket, right? It comforts you. Last night, our grandson stayed with us. He didn't go down great. He was up, and he was a little upset. And Tide, grandfather, made a mistake. He forgot to give him his blanket, you know? And it's a soft blanket. It's really nice. It comforted him, right? And so kind of we think about, okay, God is your comfort. He is a nice soft blanket who will simply soothe you and make you feel better. You'll stop crying and you'll have a good night's sleep. Actually, this word comfort is a word, it's a really incredibly strong word. It means God is my encouragement. God is my refuge. God is my strength. God is the one who takes in the middle of a messed up world and a messed up life, and he enters in and he does something profound. He is my comfort. If we were going to translate that into kind of modern-day wording, I think it would be this: I can do hard things. So a couple of days ago, or really over the last several months, our grandson Atreus, my daughter has taught him to say, "I can do hard things." So in the middle of doing something, and he's climbing and whatever, you go, "Hey, can I help you?" And he goes, "I can do hard things, Tide." You know, I'm like, okay, sorry, you know. I can do hard things. It's like in a culture that doesn't have much resilience to difficulty. In fact, teachers and administrators are talking about the lack of resilience in kids' lives, the ability to stand up under difficult deals. So I have this little grandson, said, "I can do hard things, Tide." And it reminds me of this. It's not just I can do hard things, but he's saying, I can do hard things through God who strengthens me, because he is my comfort. He is my strength. He is my encouragement. He is the one who is there. When everything else leaves, when every person leaves you, when you are left by yourself, when you are violated by everyone else, when you are cheated on, when they abandon you, when they attach themselves in other places, guess what? You're left with two things. You're left with yourself, and you're left with God. That's all you've got. And that's what he's saying here. God is my comfort. I've been abandoned by everything else, but God is my comfort. So let's look at Nehemiah a little bit. You know, you guys, the book of Nehemiah, there are hundreds of things we could draw out of it. So I'm only going to draw a few. You could go in and draw a million more things out of it, but I'm going to draw a few. So let's look at this. Nehemiah chapter 1. This set up the whole book. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. Now, you guys, just so you know, we have no idea who Hakaliah was. We know very little about Nehemiah. We don't know the family history. He doesn't come from a line of prophets. He comes from a line of a guy named Hakaliah. That's all we know. He probably is a third or fourth generation living in Persia, in Babylon. His grandfather, or maybe even his great-grandfather, was one of those who were exiled from Israel. Came to Babylon. The family never left. They stayed, assimilated there. And now he's grown up there. And somehow he finds himself in this position, and we'll see what that is. But the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, it says, now it happened in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year. Now, Chislev is November, December, so it's kind of late in the year. And it says, in the 20th year, as I was in Susa, the citadel. Now, you guys, because we love maps here at Quest, I got a map for you today. Here's a map of the Persian Empire. They've taken over the Babylonian Empire. And this is kind of the whole empire of the Persians. Now, let's circle over here on the left, Palestine, or Israel, Judah, Jerusalem. That's over here on the Mediterranean Sea, okay? Now, for the Babylonian Empire, here's Babylon. You know, this arrow will point to it. That's where Babylon is. That's the capital of the Babylonian Empire. But we find that here, Nehemiah is in Susa. Susa is a little bit farther to the east, a little bit farther south, in modern-day Iran. And this is the winter capital, the winter palace of the Persian Empire. And this is where we find Nehemiah at this point, okay? So, let's go back. And he says, now it happened in the month of Chislev, the 20th year, and I was in Susa the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brothers, evidently Nehemiah had brothers. Sometimes we picture these guys as they're always by themselves, right? They're not part of a family. But actually, he has a brother named Hanani, one of my brothers. He came with certain men from Judah. So evidently, his brother had returned to Israel and now come back. And so they're traveling back and forth. It's a long trip, but people do that, right? You can go on horseback. And so he comes back, and he says, and I asked them concerning the Jews, or concerning my people, who had escaped or had been returned to Israel. He goes, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. Tell me, how's it going? What's going on there? In verse 3, and they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. You see, people had returned. There were really three waves of people returning to Israel, to Judah. And they were separated by about 20 years, these different waves. And the first wave, evidently, under Zerubbabel, they had done well for a while, but then they started to do very poorly. There were enemies, there were opposition, and it began to go very poorly. Things were not getting better. And so he says the remnant there are in great trouble and shame. And it says, the wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. So any ancient city survived by having a wall around it that protected it. If you don't have that, you're vulnerable. And their walls were burned down, the city gates were burned down, and they were simply victims of anybody and everybody that wanted to come through and cause trouble. So, now let's go on to verse 4 through 11. And we're going to find that wisdom starts with humility. That's where wisdom starts. Wisdom, sometimes we think of it being prideful. You know, kind of like, okay, I'm really wise. You need to listen to me. But it starts with humility. Look at this in verse 4. As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned, not just for a few minutes. He wept and he mourned for days, hearing of the condition of the people back in Jerusalem. And I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. And I said, you guys, listen to this prayer. This is powerful prayer. O Lord, God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments. You guys, this God that we're talking about is an awesome God. This is a God who keeps covenant, keeps relationship, who keeps promises. This is a God who has steadfast love. The Hebrew word is hesed. It's one of the greatest words in the entire New Testament. And I'm sorry, Old Testament. It's this word hesed. It is the loving kindness, the steadfast love of God. Steadfast. It doesn't go away. It's strong. It comforts. It's reliable. And it's based in who he is as a person and in his character, who keeps steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments. God, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open and hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for the people of Israel, your servants, confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. even I and my father's house have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules that you have commanded your servant Moses. God, you told us this from long past, and we walked away. You guys, I don't know where Nehemiah, what he had done with the first 40 years of his life. But my feeling is he probably did pretty well between he and the Lord and he and people. But he also understood that he was in this group of people who had walked away from God. And they'd acted corruptly towards him. And he's confessing it. And God had spoken through Moses and many other times and places to what he wanted them from them. Now look at this in verse 8. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, which they had been, right? I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are on the uttermost parts of heaven, from there I will gather them and bring them to the place that I have chosen to make my name dwell there. It's the same thing that Jeremiah prayed in chapter 29 when he said, I have a future for you to repent and return to me, and I will build you up and I will return you to what I planned for you from the very beginning. Wow. Look at verse 10. They are your servants and your people whom you have redeemed by your great power and by your strong hand. You guys, God wants to restore. Now, what does it look like? I can't tell you I know for sure in all the ways, but I don't think that it's the kind of magical, mystical Disneyland experience that we all kind of want out of God. It's more profound than that. He restores the human heart, and then he restores the human hearts for each other. You know, Malachi talks about the hearts of fathers to be returned to their children, and their children's hearts being returned to their parents. And our hearts being restored to God, and God's heart is given to us. God wants to do some things. Now maybe verse 11 might be the key one. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant, and to the prayer of your servants who delight to fear your name. Yeah, it's a pretty powerful little phrase there, isn't it? To delight in honoring him. To fear him doesn't mean to be afraid. It means to have such high respect, high honor, high love for that. He has who delight to fear your name, to lift him up. Say, God, I honor you as God. And I want that in my life. Wow. And to give success to your servants today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, the king. And then he finishes it by saying, now I'm the cupbearer of the king. So his position as a cupbearer of the king was probably it was kind of a mixed bag. A cupbearer would mean that he's testing all the food and the wine that's given to the king, because one of the greatest and most popular ways to kill kings was to poison their food. Okay, that was just done a lot. And so his role was to both test the wine and the food, and then if he died, then the king knew, I'm not going to eat that meal. I'm not going to do it. Because unfortunately, Nehemiah is dead. He's gone. That's a bummer. But that was his role. But probably he was so trusted that he also participated in a broader form of the government. He was an advisor. He was someone that Artaxerxes held really high in his own life. He was probably a eunuch, meaning he had been castrated. That's what happened to Jewish people who worked in the government there. That's unfortunate, right? But he was so trusted that he was a cupbearer of the king. Wow. So, but you guys, the first step of wisdom is humility and confessing the reality of our lives. Telling God and those that we need to tell, here's the truth about me. And about we've walked away from you, God. We have violated you. We've treated you with contempt. And he starts there and he asks God to work and to be redemptive, right? Well, I think the second thing I want to draw out of this in Nehemiah chapter 2 is that God takes root in wisdom takes root in preparation. Wisdom prepares, right? And here's what it looks like. Look at Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 4 through 11. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, the wine was before him. Probably means that he was throwing a banquet. There was probably a celebration going on. The wine was before him. And he took the wine and he gave it to the king. He tested it already, made sure it was okay. And now I had not been sad in his presence. Remember, he'd been praying and fasting. He'd been brokenhearted, weeping and mourning for many, many days, for probably many weeks. Maybe even months long he had been doing it. And so he brings this to him and he says, I had not been sad in his presence. And the king said to me, hey, Nehemiah, why is your face sad? What's going on? I notice that your spirit seems to be low. And I'll tell you what, Nehemiah is like not happy about this, right? He's like, you don't come into the presence of the king and be all down and out. You better be on your game, right? And that's what he's supposed to be doing. And he's seeing that you are not sick. I know you're not sick, but what's going on here, Nehemiah? He says, is this nothing but sadness of the heart? Is that a great line or what? You guys, isn't it something that we all feel and experience? A sadness of the heart. That's part of the human experience here on this earth, is the things that really get you, whether it be a sickness in the family, a death of a loved one, a broken relationship, a strained situation, the being misrepresented, the sadness of the human heart, I think is what we all experience. And it's one of the most painful things. And he says, and here Artaxerxes says, is this not a sadness of your heart? And then he says, Nehemiah writes, then I was very much afraid because this ain't cool. He goes on and he said, I said to the king, let the king live forever. King, I'm not here anything against you. I hope you do great. But why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? So he's honest. He's up front. He told him, yeah, here's the deal. It's not against you. I'm not ready to rebel. I'm not trying to kill you. But my homeland, which I've never been to, it's where my great-grandfather was born. But I've gotten news that it's doing terribly. Wow, look at this in verse 4. And the king said to me, then what are you requesting? I love this. Obviously, he respected Nehemiah in a huge way. Didn't have a big, long discussion. He says, well, what do you need? What do you need? So here it goes. So I prayed to the God of heaven. So he's like, this is the moment, right? This is the moment I think he'd probably been hoping for, didn't know if it would come. And so he prayed. I get the impression this is one of those really short prayers. You ever have those? Like you walk into your boss's office and he says something and you're like, all right, Lord, here we go. You know, you don't say it out loud, but you're like, okay, let's roll. God, I hope, you know, do your thing. And so it's a really short little prayer. And he prayed to the God of heaven and he said to the king, if it pleases the king, if your servant has found favor in your sight, if I've done well, if I've proven myself, if my wisdom and integrity and the hope that I've brought to the table, if it means anything to you, here's what he says, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it. I want to go back. I want to fix it. You know, and the king knew exactly what that meant. I'm going to lose one of my most trusted advisors. I'm going to lose the person who's protecting my life. This is going to cost me a ton financially. It's part of the Persian Empire, right? It's not just like, well, he'll go and see if you can raise some money. I mean, he goes, this is going to cost me a lot of money for you to do this. He goes, well, what do you need? And he goes, well, send me back. And the king said to him, with the queen sitting right there to hold him accountable, as most wives do, how long will you be gone? And when are you going to be back? I love it. All right. When are you going to be back? I don't want to lose you forever. You guys, he was gone 12 years. 12 years he was gone. How long are you going to be gone? So it pleased the king to send me, and when I had given him a time. You see, he gave him a time because he was prepared. He knew this is how long it's going to take. And so he thought it through. Look at this in verse 7. He said, I said to the king, not only that, I'll be back in 12 years, but here's what he says. If it pleases the king, let letters be given to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah. He knew there was opposition, so he goes, I need documents that let me through, that they're not going to kill me, okay? Got it. verse 8, and a letter to Asaph, a keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the and the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall occupy. And the king said, it's yours. He granted it, and he said, what I asked for the good hand of God was upon me. He had a plan. How long is it going to take you? What's it going to cost? Where are you going to get your stuff? And he says, here it is. He had prepared it. He thought it through beforehand. He was prepared. That's wisdom. Walking in with no idea or no plan is foolish, right? He walked in. This is why God used him. He developed him to this place. He had a plan. All right. But then he also knew that he couldn't do it by himself, right? He can't do all this by himself. Can't rebuild the walls. Can't rebuild the gates. The temple's already rebuilt, but it's starting to show wear because it's so open. And so wisdom in Nehemiah 2 and 3 is going to say wisdom unfolds in delegation. It unfolds in delegation. Look at this. In chapter 2, verse 17, it says, then I said to them, you see the trouble we are now in. He says this to the people. He'd already surveyed the city. When he got to Jerusalem by himself, he got on a horse, and he surveyed the entire city one night, looked at everything, rode all the way around it, and he looked at what was in it. There were hardly any buildings inside the city. They'd all been knocked down. Everybody was living in little villages outside of town. And he says, man, this is a mess. And so the next morning, he gets together with all the leaders and all the people, and he says, listen, you see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins and its gates are burned. Come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision. What a great word, derision. This corruptness, this degradation, if you will. And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words of the king had spoken to me. He says, hey, you guys, I've already talked to King Artaxerxes. He gave me 12 years to be here. He's promised us all the timbers we need to rebuild. I've prepared. And he says, let's rebuild. And if it comes and says, hey, let's rebuild, but I have no plan, people are going to say, great, good luck. You know, I'm going to stay home. But he says, no, I've got it all coming. The next train coming into town is loaded with timber. I've got wagons coming with all sorts of hardware. I've got logistics have been done, right? Preparing what needs to go where, how, when. He's already done it all. And so they said, all right, let us rise up and build. Look at that beautiful line. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. You can just see them. They said, all right, I can do hard things. We can do hard things because God is with us. And you have prepared. Wow. Now, you guys look at this in verse 3. And just kind of the whole chapter is like this. And then Elisha, the high priest, rose up with his brothers and priests, and they built the sheep gate. I mean, the religious dudes, like, okay, man, we're in. And they helped. And then next to him, the men of Jericho built. People came from Jericho and helped build next to him. And next to them, Zakur, the son of the Imri, built. And the sons of Hasaniah built the fish gate. And next to them, Meremoth, and all these people, just one, they're all organized next to each other, building. Like, hey, you're doing a good job. Oh, look, you missed that spot. Don't you hate that when you're painting? Hey, you missed that spot. But, you know, they're just helping each other. They're all building next to each other. Look at all that. And then you could go all the way through. Look at verse 32. And between the upper chamber and the corner of the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and the merchants repaired. Even the jewelry dudes came and they got involved. And they're fixing it all. He got everyone involved to do their section. You guys, the building of God's kingdom takes everyone. It wasn't just Nehemiah. He needed to prepare and give leadership. But he had to get everybody involved. Now, you guys, look at verse 5, right in the middle there. It says, next to them, the Tekoites repaired. Look at this, though. But their nobles would not stoop to serve their Lord. Not everyone got involved. There were certain people who said, I'm above it. It's a really good lesson. You know, most people will get involved, but some are going to say, too good for it. Thanks. I don't swing a hammer. I don't lift rocks. I don't do that kind of thing. I don't get dirty. Not doing it. Everyone needs to get involved. You know what? Even Nehemiah There were times where he put down his leadership role and he simply built wall. That's what leaders do. Well, here's another thought. Wisdom stays strong in the face of opposition. There's always going to be opposition. You guys, I think this is one that we really need to grab onto today. There is going to be opposition if we stand for what is right. Let's do it well. But wisdom stays strong in the face of opposition. Look at this in Nehemiah 4. Now in Sanballat, there were three people who really stood up against Nehemiah. One was to the north of Jerusalem, one was south of Jerusalem, one was east of Jerusalem. And these guys stood against him. He says, when Sanballat, this guy was to the north of Jerusalem, heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. Ooh, isn't that like strong words? Like, whoa, it sounds like some of the meetings we have around our culture today. But he said, in the presence of his brothers and of the army of Samaria, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will you restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? No, they'll give up quickly. Don't worry about it. Will they finish up in a day? Oh, this is a joke. But here's the deal. They did finish in 52 days, just so you know. But will you finish in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burns ones at all? So Tobiah the Amorite, he is to the south, was beside him, and he said, yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their wall. This little fox, if he touches it, it's going to fall down. What they're doing is totally stupid. It's inadequate. It's dumb. And then look at this in verse 4. This is Nehemiah. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captive. Do not cover their guilt and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders. So we build the wall. So we built the wall, and all the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. God, you take care of the opposition, but we're going to build. We're not stopping. We're going to keep going. And the people had a mind to work. And then Sanballat and Tobiah of the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the repairing of the walls of Jerusalem was going forward and that the breaches were beginning to be closed, and they were really smoked. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to cause confusion in it. And we prayed to our God and set a guard as a protection against them day and night. He prayed. And he set a guard, a real practical reality. Day and night, they set up guards. Guard us. Protect us. And so I think what happens here is that wisdom stays strong in the face of opposition. Last one. Wisdom, in chapter 5, wisdom sees those who are disenfranchised. You know, any project, any movement, there are people who get caught in the vice, the disenfranchised, the abused, the ones who are hurt by certain things. That's what had been happening in Israel for years. And as they began to rebuild, there were some people who were suffering as a result. Look at this. And he saw it. Nehemiah saw it. Now there arose a great cry of the people and of their wives against the Jewish brothers. So there's internal conflict, right? For there were those who said, our sons and our daughters, we are many. So let us get grain and that we may eat and keep alive. We're hurting. We're food deprived. This hasn't worked out well for us. This has been difficult. We've joined in the work, but we're not doing very well. Verse 3, and there were also those who said, we are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our houses to get grain because of the famine. This has been really hard. We're putting up collateral simply to eat. Verse 4, and there were those who said, we have borrowed money from the king's taxes on our fields and our vineyards. This has been hard. We've been taxed so heavily. We're struggling. Verse 5, now our flesh is as the flesh of our brothers. Our children are as their children. We're just like they are, yet we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. We're hiring them out in a very difficult situation. And for some of our daughters have already been enslaved. This is probably an indentured kind of thing, but we'd have to hire them out. But it is not in our power to help it, for other men have our fields and our vineyards. They've mortgaged them to rich people who are taking advantage of them. Verse 6, this is Nehemiah. I was very angry. And when I heard their outcry and these words, I took counsel with myself, meaning I looked in the mirror carefully. I considered this meaningfully. I stopped and wrestled with it. I didn't just blow it off. I really engaged this. Who's getting hurt? Who's getting left behind? Who's disenfranchised by what's going on here? And he was very angry. And who's taking advantage of who, even in this situation? Do you know that in times of poverty, many times the rich get richer because they use people? It happens. So he took counsel with himself and he brought charges against the nobles and officials who had abused people. And he said to them, "You are exacting interest, each from his brother. You are using people in the midst of this difficulty." And he held a great assembly against them. He gathered people together, and he said to them, "We, as far as we are able, have brought back our Jewish brothers who have been sold to the nations, but you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us." We have tried to bring back all the dispersed people here, but you have used them just as much. What are you doing? Look in the next verse. And they were silent and could not find a word to say. And so Nehemiah said, "The thing that you are doing is not good. Ought you not to walk in the fear of our God to prevent the taunts of the nations and our enemies? Are you not supposed to walk in what God has done against our external enemies?" He says, "But moreover, I and my brothers and my servants are lending them money and grain. Let us abandon this exacting of interest, of abusing them. Return to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive orchards, and their houses, and the percentage of money, grain, wine, and oil that you have been exacting from them. Let's stop the internal conflict. Let's treat people. Stop using them." Verse 12, "And then they said, 'We will restore these and require nothing from them. We will do as you say.'" Next slide. "And I called the priests and made them swear to do what they had promised. And I also shook out the fold of my garment and said, 'So may God shake out every man from his house and from his labor who does not keep this promise. So may he be shaken out and emptied.' And all the assembly said, 'That's right.' And they praised the Lord, and the people did as they had promised." Because wisdom protects people who are disenfranchised, people who are left on the margins of life. It understands what it does, and we say, "We're not going to do that. We'll take on with bravery those who oppose us from without, but we're going to take on the things that we do wrong on the inside too. And we're going to protect people who are hurting." So the real question here as we wrap up is, how did Nehemiah navigate living in Babylon? How did he do it? He did it with wisdom. He did it with great discernment and discretion. And so really the question then is, how can we navigate living in this post-Christian culture? How do we do it? One that's radically changing, where there's a tsunami, where profound things are happening. How do we do it? I think we do it with wisdom. One of the things we have to bring to the table is wisdom. And it's a wisdom that starts with humility. Takes stock of our own lives. It's a wisdom that is rooted in being prepared, thinking it through, knowing what we're talking about, knowing what to do, how to organize it, how to go about it. It unfolds in delegation because we all have to be a part of it. Not one person can do it. It is a team effort, and everyone is on the team. Everyone's on the team. You have a position to play. You have an assignment to do. When we say hike, we all know what we're going to do together so that we can run this play. It stays strong in the face of opposition because the opposition is going to be there. And you say, "God, you're going to need to deal with them because I'm going to continue working. I'm going to continue on the job." And then the last one, it sees those who are hurting. who are disenfranchised, that we take care of each other. I think that's wisdom. I think that's where he wants us to go. And so, you guys, as we deal with living in Babylon, it's a difficult place, right? I think he would say, let's be wise. Let's have discretion and discernment. Let's exercise this wisdom. Now, you guys, there's 1,000 more things that Nehemiah has to tell us. But those are probably enough for us to run on for a while. And so my prayer would be for us and for me to be people of great wisdom, people of great discernment and discretion about how to live in Babylon. So I want you to just take a moment, think it through, wrestle with yourself, take counsel with yourself, just like Nehemiah. That God, show me what you need me to do. What do you want me to do? How can I grow in this area of wisdom so that I know how to live in Babylon effectively? So take a moment just to pray, and let me start us off. Oh God, you are our God. We seek you. Our soul thirsts for you. Our flesh is thirsty to do and to be who you called us to be. We live in a dry and weary land where there is no water. But your steadfast love is better than life itself, and in that we will praise you. Father, give us wisdom. And hear your people.